Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, and along with an ensemble of gifted hosts, Greg Audell, Drs. Warren Holloman and Mary Edgerton, engineer and media maven Nicole Rocherlin, and our newest member of the team, Tatiana Gago, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on storytellers who take us through the windows of their souls with moving narratives and magical treks through the halls of enchantment with folktales and more. You know, stories rock our world because they help us connect through gestures, words, and voice instead of screens, software, and circuits. Last week, Warren treated us to an excursion through the fragile lives of Houstonians post-Harvey. And with the help of journalists from the Chronicle, we followed their lives even when the water reached over their heads, as paddles from canoes drifted away through undercurrents, and our neighbors fought undertows that likened an unsuspecting turn when swimming in the Gulf. Tragedies outside our homes, on streets where our children play, and where porch lights welcome our friends. Harvey took its toll, but as we've heard and felt, it didn't take our spirit. Tonight, we're going to carry this just a tad further by dispensing an even greater range of narratives about devastating moments in which overcoming the odds seemed impossible. The kind that may not be induced by a storm, but rather a storm that disturbs our very core. To help me make the point, I have two students alive and well breathing in the studio, and two students on CDs to augment them. Jamesetta Marshall is, in my view, artistically ambidextrous because her communication studies major has prompted her to cultivate the love of radio, television, storytelling, and a whole lot more. She is also an award-winning poet with a signature style as unique as her poetry. She plans to pursue a career as a talk show host, preferably in television, but she'll succeed wherever that place and the venue fortunate enough to have her in their employ meet. Joey Mann is a senior interdisciplinary studies major with a minor in communication studies. We love him despite the fact that he transferred from A&M and openly admits to be an Aggie fan. He wants to stay in his career as a pipe salesman, but is toying with stand-up comedy as well. How you guys doing?
Great.
Very good.
Okay, you can say something. We can all hear your voices. That's great. Glad to have you guys here. And I am really excited to hear your stories. I know something about them, but the whole world will in any moment, because all of you know this is internationally broadcasted, right? The entire world will get this particular show. So I just wanted you to feel that kind of pressure. When did you realize, Joey, when did you realize that you were funny enough for a stand-up? We're just trying to figure out if you're funny at all, but apparently somebody told you that you're funny.
Well, it all kind of started back when I joined a fraternity up at A&M. I used to kind of get myself into kind of sticky situations that I would be able to tell with a humorous back tone at our weekly chapter meetings. And that's when my friends told me, hey, you should give comedy a shot.
Do you have a non-dirty joke that you can tell us? Created?
I mean, unfortunately not. I mean, they're all pretty pretty south of the appropriate line. So, you know, it's my radio debut, so I'm trying to keep it clean for the first get out. I got some family members listening.
Yeah. I told the joke today without even realizing it, you know. Somebody said something like, you know, I thought you were dead, and I said, wow, that's a grave situation. I thought it was the best I could do at the time, but nevertheless. What characteristics, Joey, do you think stand-up comics need to impress you?
Well, I think it's very important for them to be relatable. You know, everybody can relate to what they're saying. They tell stories that are entertaining and that carry a good punchline. Obviously, that's crucial when it comes to comedy, but I think being relatable to the audience is the most important thing when it comes to being a comedian.
One time I was asked if I've ever done stand-up. I was, I did, what is so funny? What is so funny? I did open mic at the Laugh Stop once, you know, that place that was on West Gray many, many years ago.
How did that go?
It didn't go well.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah, I'll tell you why it did go fairly well, better than I thought. I went last, and I knew everybody would be drunk at that time. I just knew that.
That's also important.
It didn't make any difference what I said. People laughed a little bit, and I felt really good about myself, nevertheless. Okay, now, Joey, you know, you got a pretty good job, and you're very serious about completing your degree, and I really admire that genuinely. Now, when I said that you were a pipe salesman, it doesn't mean a tobacco pipe. So tell us what you do.
I work for a pipeline company that, I do sales for. I strictly sell inventory for this pipeline company. So oil filled pipe, you know, structural pipe, whatever you want to do with it, barbecue pits, anything.
And, what do you, want to do with your degree?
Well, I majored in communications cause I'd been doing sales, or I didn't major in it, but my minor is in communications cause I've been doing sales. I enjoy sales very much. Mainly, it's very important to me and my family that, you know, we all finish our degrees and kind of carry on with our careers after that.
You know, James Zetta, I just want to switch to James Zetta for a moment. You are really kind of a professor's dream.
I am.
Joey is too, but you are for a different reason. You are. Communication didn't really hit you as a career until you were inspired by certain courses and professors, right?
That is correct.
Yeah. Tell us one thing that was said to you in some class that made an indelible impression on you.
It was amazing. The day before, I was sitting in my car asking God, who am I? Who am I? People had always told me who I could be. I could be an actress. I could be a doctor. Mm-hmm. I could be a speaker. But no one told me who I was.
And
the next day, I came to Dr. Rubichek's class, and he gave me this.
I don't want anyone to think that I'm suggesting I'm God.
Okay, because he is not. I give my grade.
What do you mean he is not?
He is not God. Trust me on this one.
This is the God of communication.
I get this paper, and it has a plethora of words on the back.
I like that word. You learned that.
Yes, I did. A plethora of words on the back. But the first five words is what grabbed me. It said, James Zetta, and the next four words were underlined twice with three exclamations in the back and said, James Zetta, you are a storyteller.
Wow.
And right then, I knew that God was using this professor to tell me who I was. And it was just a profound moment.
Yeah. You know, I know you love storytelling, but how does a good story make you feel?
It makes me feel free. If I had to say it in one word, good stories make me feel free.
Makes you feel free. What does that mean?
It means that, you know, with the hustle and bustle of life and having to put on a face for everything. You have to look this way. You have to dress this way. Your hair should be this way. You know, all the different rules and regulations when you go to different places and talk to different people, how you should appear. When I tell a story or I hear a good story, I feel like none of that matters, that I actually can be myself. I could turn in a circle and I'm Wonder Woman at that point.
Joey, how about you?
Well, you know, having an interest in comedy, I mean, a good story to me just brings joy to people. Mm-hmm. And seeing, you know, the transition from start to finish, especially if it's a funny story, even if it's a sad story, it just kind of makes you feel, I don't know, I guess a little complete after you hear it. You can relate with the person. You know, you go through the roller coasters of emotions that they go through when telling the story. And I think it's just a good part of life to hear good stories and relate to them.
And those are great responses, really. They do complete us, and they do make us feel things. And feeling is something that we don't do nearly as often as we should. I did a workshop today with Exxon, and they want to start using stories in their business presentations. And they told me that last week, somebody did a presentation and talked about storytelling for 2 hours with PowerPoint, and they never told a story.
Oh my God.
I said, well, how was that done? And they said, well, they just told us what to do, and we're supposed to do it. Well, how does the person know if you can do it if they never heard the story? You know, that may not seem very profound, but the idea is that you have to tell a story, you have to feel it, and you have to sense of how people respond to it. You really do. James Zetta, let's start with you and your story. You know, Mark Twain said, show me someone who knows what's funny, and I'll show you someone who knows what isn't. And I think this adage helps us travel to the nucleus of your story and about the power of humor. Tell us your story.
So my mother used to always tell me that there's no such thing as coincidences, that it's only God proving that he is still doing miracles. And I don't know if I really believe that or not, but I do know how it made me feel. It made me feel so good to hear that God could still do miracles. And I guess that's why I'm attached to this story so much. I had a friend, and his name is Big Man. He was big, and he was a man, so we were creative with that. We called him Big Man. And when Big Man left college, he had met his wife, and he started his family. He had these three kids. And it's not the first two older kids that really caught my attention. It was his younger child, the first son that he had. And his son was so much like him, more like him than Big Man could have been himself. So we started calling his son Little Man Man. And so Big Man had decided that every year he was going to take his family on vacation. And this year, no different from any other year, Big Man is always in the expedition, blowing on the horn, screaming at his wife and kids, "It's time to go, it's time to go, it's time to go," screaming out the window. Everyone in the neighborhood is paying attention because they know they do this on the first week of July. He's screaming and screaming. The wife is running to the door saying, "I'll be out in 15 seconds, and she's never coming out. Finally, the whole family gets outside, and they get in the car. And Big Man waits to hear the three sounds that he always hear before he reverses. He hears the front passenger door slams. He hears the back passenger door slams. He hears the back driver passenger door slams. He puts the car in reverse and he begins to continue screaming, "Oh my God, every time it's time to go on vacation, you all are late." The wife, she says what she always says, "Oh, shut it up. We're in the car by now. Let's just go." So he reversed the car, and when he reversed the expedition, it goes up in the back as if he drove over a mountain. He changes the argument to another argument. "I have asked you kids to keep your bicycles out of the driveway. I don't understand why I keep buying new bicycles when every time I turn around, I'm driving over another bicycle." And as he turns around to confront his three kids, he realizes only two of the kids are in the expedition. His little boy is not. He asks his daughters, "Where's Little Man Man?" And they said, "He got back out the truck to get his toy off the ground." His wife and him jump out the truck, and they are horrified. Their hearts are beating 100 miles per hour. They're hoping that their worst nightmare is not about to happen. And he's running around the truck looking at tire after tire. And he finds that Little Man Man is laying down on the ground, and the back passenger tire is on top of Little Man Man's head. The wife is on her knees. She starts holding on to Little Man Man, his hand, and all the people in the neighborhood without any stage direction is around the expedition. She looks at her husband and says, "Do something." And his legs respond before his mind can even think. He jumps in the driver's seat. He puts his foot on the brakes. He brings the stick down to drive, and he asks God quickly, "Should I drive fast or slow?" And while he's saying this question prayer, this doctor is driving through the neighborhood, and he sees this group of people around the expedition. Of course, anytime a doctor sees a crowd, he knows that there is a need for a doctor. He jumps out the car. He runs through the crowd. He's pushing people out the way. "I'm a doctor. I'm a doctor. I'm a doctor." He sees the expedition. He begins to bang on the back window and said, "Don't drive," because his eyes catch the scene so quickly. The son is laying on the floor, on the ground, the tires on his head. The dad is in the driver's seat. He runs to the driver's side. He bangs on the window, "Do not move this car." Big Man Man opens the door and he says, "Why?" He says, "If you move this car, you will crush your child's skull. He will die immediately." The doctor runs to the child and he does all the things that a doctor should do. The crowd is calling 911. Big Man says it takes the firemen and the ambulance 12 minutes to get there, but it felt like 12 hours. The fireman manually picks the truck off of Little Man Man's head. The people off the ambulance take him and put him on the ambulance. They rush him to the hospital. The whole family is at the hospital. The lead doctor meets the doctor in the neighborhood, and he asks, "Can I be in the surgery room with you?" The lead doctor says, "Yes, we need all the hands we can get." They go into the surgery room. Hours they're performing on Little Man Man. They finally come out looking tired, rinsing their hands in one another, taking off this skull physician hat and walking up to the mother and the father. And Big man asks, he says, is he alive? Directly, the doctor says, yes, but he's in critical condition. We don't know if he's going to make it through the night. Can we talk to him? The mother asks. He says, no, he's in a coma. You can see him, but we don't know if he's going to make it through the night. How long would he be in the coma? Big man asks. The doctor has no response. He said, it could be a day. It could be a week. We don't know. So finally, they're sitting there, and when the doctor walks off, the doctor that was in the neighborhood says to Big Man, I don't believe in coincidences. I don't believe that God brought me to this neighborhood to stop you from killing your son just so he could die in this hospital room. And though that felt so great to their hearts, they just still was full of worry. So now they're in this room, and day one, day two, day three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11 days pass. The room is full of relatives. And on day 12, little man opened his eyes. The mother says, oh, my God, he's waking up. And Big Man sitting, standing there in the corner crying, clearly thinking of all the things he did wrong 12 days ago to put his son in the hospital. It's just standing there. And the first words little man say is, where is my daddy? His daddy runs over to him, pushes all the relatives out the way, pushes his daughter, pushes his mom out the way, falls down to his knees. He holds little man's hands. He said, your daddy is right here. And little man looks at him and says, daddy, as he touches his cheek. And he says, yes, yes, I'm right here. And little man with all the personality that he has, turns one head to the side, closes one of his eyes, opens the other, points it at his father and says, you ran over my head, daddy. And the whole room just busts out in laughter. And at that moment, I realized that there is no such thing as coincidence. It is just God proving that he still performs miracles.
Wow, what a beautiful story. That really is a beautiful story. And I saw that coming too, the idea of coincidences. That story, as it unfolds in your mind, right?
Yes.
What are you thinking about as it unfolds in your mind?
I'm seeing the picture. I'm seeing little man. I'm seeing hope lose. And then at the end, I'm realizing that God always is in place. And he's a comedian as well, because who would know that this little boy, all the time he is in a coma, the one thing he wants to say is, you ran over my head, daddy.
That's amazing. That is amazing. Last Friday, Jennifer Tiga, I know I mentioned to some of you guys in my class, Jennifer Tiga is the award-winning author who wrote My Grandfather Would Have Shot Me.
Yes.
Does that ring a bell?
Yes.
And she was on campus, and I did a Q&A with her, and I introduced her. And the first thing she said was, I don't believe in coincidences, which is amazing, because that's what you're saying. I can't believe it. What a coincidence, right? But in any event, no, she said that she found out that she was the grandfather of Amon Gert when she was 38 years old. She walked into a Hamburg library and within 3 minutes saw a book with her mother's name in it. She traced her family heritage and realized from where she came. From that moment, she was in therapy for 7.5 years because she lived in this internal darkness, this terrible depression. And the only way to come out of it was to write this memoir and then essentially, ultimately, do presentations. But she talked about the same thing. It's not a coincidence. I don't know why I walked into that library. I don't know why I found out what I did. I don't know why I felt so emotionally distraught as I had. But there was a reason for it. And ultimately, it's about how we have to learn not to hate. It's how we have to learn to tolerate. Because she thought for so many years there was a Nazi seed in her heredity. But obviously, that's not the case. But it took her a long time. That is so beautiful. Wow. Nicole, I know that you've overcome a lot of obstacles, even devastating moments in your life. But what is the toughest one other than trying to reach the volume level on my mic? How's it coming, by the way? Listeners out there,
much
I just
better.
Want you to know
much.
That I'm speaking in a microphone. Nicole is yelling at me nonverbally, you know, like a madman mime out there, you know, and I'm trying to explain to her that after 9 years, I know where the damn mic is, but it's not working. But now it is, you're saying?
You sound great now, yes.
Yeah, right. No, I'm not. You're lying to me.
You do.
Because you want to keep your non-paid job, okay?
Don't put me on Front Street.
But you have, but really, you are a magnificent person. You know how we're good friends, and I admire you. You've done a lot of wonderful things. You really have. And I want to know what kind of obstacle comes to mind when you think of one that was really very difficult.
My biggest obstacle was taking heed to myself and actually stopping and not passing by and looking in the mirror to see if my hair is cute, but actually looking in the mirror and looking myself in the eyes and realizing that I needed to make a change.
Come on.
Wow. Well, you're a brilliant model. Did that have anything to do with it?
Well, the modeling came afterwards, but hey, kudos to me modeling.
Well, I mean, you have to find that beauty internally first, don't you?
Yes, I definitely did. And But taking heed to myself was the very first step in my journey. And it also led me to the world of communication, bridging over from healthcare. So it was just a major step that took a lot of courage. And I had to realize I had been running for a long time. And I was also lying to myself. I was being very dishonest to me, which was very detrimental to myself.
Well, that's a beautiful comment. I appreciate that. I know that's not easy. Tatiana, what about you?
For me,
Have you ever had an obstacle?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. And I'm still trying to overcome it. And I think it's doing really well so far. It's trying to overcome self-doubt. Because for a long time, I've had people tell me that I can't do things. But now I have overcome it. I'm able to accomplish things that I never knew I could even do. I've started doing kickboxing. And didn't even think I could make it to college and do so well. I realize that I am so much more capable of doing so much more than what I think I can do. I've got out of my comfort zone, and I saw how much I started to grow.
Well, what is it that people said you couldn't do, for example?
They said that I'm not necessarily ready for the world to go out, and that the world's going to eat me alive. I'm not going to do well in college if I even get to college. I've had teachers make remarks about me saying she's going to repeat the eighth grade. We'll see how she's going to do in life.
This is the truth. You know, that my seventh grade counselor, never listened to them, called my mother and said that I won't go to college. I ought to get involved into shop and mechanical drawing right away. I didn't even know what a hammer was. You have to understand, they stick me in shop. I called it a mallet. The guy flunked me. In shop, I flunked shop because never mind. Yeah, it was a ridiculous thing, and I made a plastic pen and pencil set that flew off of the buffer and hit him in the face, and it was just awful.
You are making
and
this
I did that
up
on purpose.
As you go.
I'm telling you the truth.
This up as
Don't
you
listen
go.
To people. My grandfather gave me the best advice. He said, take my advice and don't take anybody's advice. That's the best advice, and that's the truth. You know, to conquer oneself is a greater task than conquering others. That's what tonight is all about with guest tellers, James Etta Marshall and Joey Mann. And Nicole Rochelin and Tatiana Gago on So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 with our friends in Huntsville. I'm your host, Hank Rubicek. You know, my students always amaze me with both their talent and their strength. Here's a case in point. Katie Galloway was in Jay Staley's storytelling course. Now, Jay's been a guest on this program many times, so when he told me that he had a student with an astonishing story about overcoming odds to tell, I wanted to listen. And she came to my office, and my jaws remained open for an hour. I was in awe. This is from November 21st, 2013, Katie Galloway. Nicole?
It was my 18th birthday. And all of my friends took me out to Chuy's Mexican Food Restaurant for the most delicious chicken fajitas. If you've never been there, shame on you. And we were so gorged, but of course, someone says, well, what are we having for dessert? Because no matter how much self-loathing is involved, you always have to have dessert. There's always space for that. So my best friend Greer says, oh, well, I have an idea, but you guys are just going to have to trust me on this one. Which is always a bad idea, but we said, okay, we're 18, we're invincible, let's do it. So we go down Westheimer, and all of a sudden she says, okay, turn in here, it's House of Pies. And I turn in, and I was terrified. There was a homeless man on the sidewalk, and the building itself looked like it could just fall down at any moment when you open the door. And we thought, well, we'll trust her. So we walk in the front door, and I was hoping it would get better, and it just got worse. I felt like I had walked into a time warp. There were bacon and pancakes and fruit on the wallpaper, and the waitresses were dressed in these horrid maroon dresses with the hose and the grandma shoes and the smoker voices, and it just felt like I had stepped back in time to the 70s. And so I thought, oh, God, I'm going to die of food poisoning on my 18th birthday. This is so bad. And she said, just trust me. So we sit down, and there's this paper menu, and it has dozens of pies on it. And I'm just thinking to myself, I'm so indecisive, and I have no idea which one to choose. But then I thought, well, you can't mess up apple pie. So I get the apple pie, and it's warm, and the ice cream is on the side, and I think, okay, here goes. And I took a bite, and I knew in that moment that my life had changed, that this was special. And so the next weekend, I said, I have got to bring my brother, who was 16 at the time, Austin, and my little sister, Julie, who was 11, to House of Pies so that they could experience this with me. So I throw them in the car, and we get there, and they have pretty much the same exact response to it that I did. And they were terrified, and I said, just trust me, just trust me. So they fell in love with it just like I did on that very first night. And over that summer before I left for college, I tried to take them there a couple times a month at least and just really build that bond with them and make sure that they knew that I was always going to be their big sister even though I was moving away and that they could always count on me. And also the people watching there is indescribable, but there's just nothing quite like being there at 1 o'clock in the morning and watching a cougar with mascara running down her face trying to hit on some poor Joe Schmo over fried eggs and the tweaker in the corner that you're not sure might shank you, and just bonding with all the servers that have such interesting life stories. And so we just really grew together. And and when I would come home from school for Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever, that was the first place we went. I would pick up Austin and Julie, and we would go to House of Pies and catch up and just have a good time. And we always kind of had this unspoken rule that that was our special place. We never took our parents, which I think they would have put the kibosh on it if they had seen it. And we never took friends. It was just the three of us. And so when Austin came to me one day and said, hey, I'd really like to bring my girlfriend, Catherine, he didn't admit it, but I knew that must mean she was special. And so I said, okay, sure, why not? And over that night at House of Pies, I knew that she was so important to him and that she was perfect for my baby brother. And so from then on, she was kind of in the gang, and when she could, she would come. And so then about 2 years later, I was at school in Dallas, and I was raped, and I was in the hospital for a couple of days, and I thought I could hack it at school, but I was having panic attacks, and I couldn't leave my apartment, and so I knew that I had to move home. And I asked my parents, please don't tell Austin and Julie, I want to tell them myself. And at the time, they were 18 and 14, and I knew that they could handle the truth, but I needed it to come from me. And so I got home, and I said, hey, guys, we're going to House of Pies. And we got in the car, and I didn't say anything about it until we got there. And when we sat down and we ordered our pie, and I just told them everything. And they were crying, and I was crying, and we got our pie for free. And we just, in that moment, I realized that House of Pies was no longer just a special place for us, that it was a safe place, that it felt like coming home, that it felt like going to grandma's house. It was just warm and special. And I moved home, and about 6 months after I moved home, my brother got very, very sick. He was born with cystic fibrosis. He was diagnosed with it as a baby. And that's a lung disease that has no cure, and the prognosis is not good. And he was in the hospital for about 3 months. And while he was in the hospital, I would take him House of Pies, and I would spend the night at the hospital to give my stepmom a break to get home, but also just to have fun and hope that he could feel like he wasn't in the hospital. And the nurses hated when I went there because we were so loud and always up to no good. And then finally we got the phone call one day that he was going to get a set of lungs and they were going to be perfect for him. And so we got the surgery, went through it with flying colors, and about a week later, they sent him home, and Of course, the first place we went was House of Pies. We packed up Catherine, and I packed up Julie and Austin, and we all went to House of Pies, and he got his Bayou Goo, which is gross, but that's his favorite, and we just had so much fun, and that night was perfect. It was perfect. And 3 years later, almost to the day, my brother got very, very sick again, and unfortunately, with lung transplants in particular, the immunosuppressive drugs really make it difficult to stay healthy for very long, and so he was sick again. He was in the hospital for about a month, and one Sunday he called me and he said, "Katie, I really want House of Pies, and can you just come hang out?" And you know, I was older by then, and I had a full-time job. I was a restaurant manager working a million hours a week, and I just said, "Austin, you're gonna have to get over yourself. Stop being such a baby. I have work in the morning." And I hung up with him, and the next morning I got a call saying that he had taken a turn for the worse overnight. My dad told me that he was now too sick to get a transplant, which unfortunately is a very narrow line to walk. You have to be sick enough to need a new organ, but if you're too sick, they don't think you'll survive the surgery, and so they won't do it. And at that point, we knew that it was just a matter of time. And he was no longer lucid. They had amped up the pain medication so that he wasn't in pain. And so then on Thursday morning, my brother passed away. And the last thing I ever said to him was, "Stop being such a baby." And so that night, I packed up Catherine and Julie, and we went to House of Pies, and we cried, and we ate Bayou Goo, even though he was the only one that liked it. And we just remembered Austin. And I took one of those ugly 70s-tastic paper menus, and I took it home, and I wrote a note to my baby brother, and I said all of my hopes and dreams, and I tried to come up with a plan on how I would fill that void of him in our family. And I folded it up, and I put it in his casket, and I buried it with him. And 3 months after my brother passed away, I found out I was pregnant with the baby that I was told I couldn't have because of complications from the rape. And in that moment, I knew that this miracle was my brother's miracle, that this baby was my very own Austin. And now I look forward to the day when I can have a special place, my own House of Pies, with my very own little Austin.
Wow.
You know, I always talk about stories that I love, and some of my favorite stories, and this is, without question, one of the top two or three of my favorite stories. And I also want to say something, those of you watching Facebook Live, and this is my fault, when we are playing something, this is the beauty of live, sometimes you're watching us, and those of us in the studio are just sitting here, and it's boring and it's monotonous. But I want you to understand what we're doing. We're doing what you're doing. We're listening to the story. And Nicole has shut off the visual, so you don't have to go through that. But, you know, when we're in the studio, we are so connected to some of the beautiful stories that we hear. So I just want you to know that we apologize if you see us. We're just kind of standing here and sitting here. But we're just reaping the benefits of what you're reaping. In this story, think of the emotional shifts. I mean, she's going from her sexual assault to her brother's illness and then realizing that she's impregnated with a child of the rapist. She decides to keep the child. And in remembering her brother after her brother passes, decides to name this child after her brother. And all of that is done in 9 minutes. That's a kind of emotional roller coaster that no kaleidoscope can ever offer. Hmm. And it's just really very beautiful. Beautiful. Nicole, but there's no despair when it comes to reporting on the storytelling events around town, right?
That's right, Dr. Hank. And because we love storytelling, first, joining the Houston Storytellers Guild is the best place to start building your storytelling skills. So just get to their monthly swaps held on the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. Also, you can go to their website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for upcoming events and all of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008 is listed on the menu under the radio program. So, Tatiana, what if you don't have a radio?
No radio, no problem, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and Facebook Live. And be sure to tell us what you think about our shows or suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page. And we promise to get back to you. And please be sure to share our page with friends. And we'd love it if you like us when you leave. Anything else, Nicole?
You know what? Yes, Tatiana. Everyone should check out our program clips on our YouTube channel. And don't forget, we do have Instagram as well. Also, we don't want to miss our friends at the Moth Warehouse Live every second Tuesday of the month. So next month, the theme is creepy. The Moth is one of the top storytelling spots in town. So, Dr. Hank, you want to tell us about the Moth Grand Slam?
Love to. We don't know. No, actually, we really don't know yet, and that's the truth, but we should find out this week. I know that sounds awful, but that's the truth. It hasn't been booked yet. But, you know, check out the Moth Facebook for more, but I am sure that we're going to know by next week, and Mary will probably talk about that. Mary Edgerton is going to host pathologist Dr. Anais Malapica, whose family emerged from Cuba to Venezuela, and recounts tales that she can't get out of her mind. And knowing her, you won't be able to get them out of your mind either. It's only on So What's Your Story, and we're looking forward to that. Joey, you know, your story is really about devastation incarnate, the kind that affects keeping family members alive. Tell us your story.
Well, you know, the loss of human life is one of the hardest things that we can have to deal with, cope with throughout our lives. And whenever that happens, or mostly anything significantly sad happens, we tend to tie things to certain pieces of jewelry or maybe paintings or stuff like that that can kind of remind us of that person or what it was like whenever they were alive. As you can see, I've brought this watch from my grandfather here that recently we were able to thankfully recover from our apartment that was flooded from the floor to the ceiling after Harvey. That along with my grandmother's wedding ring, which kind of, you know, it transcends to what I'm telling this story about, which is time. And a not very long time ago, about last Christmas, I got a phone call from my mother after I was leaving the gym, something that I don't do too much. But her phone call began by simply just me saying hello, and she's saying, "Your grandmother has passed away. I will call you later." So I called my brother, my older brother, and I. He had already heard the news, and we both just kind of consoled in each other, and we were just like, what are we going to do about Mom? She was very close to her grandmother, and we knew that this was absolutely just take the breath out of her. So she was already in San Antonio where my grandmother had passed, so we had packed up our things and went over to San Antonio and got together at the funeral home where we were with six of the grandchildren, me and my brother being two of them. And none of us had ever lost anybody not as significant as my grandmother was to us. She was a staple in definitely all of our childhood. So we all kind of stood around awkwardly trying to make jokes and trying to not, you know, acknowledge the quite large elephant in the room. And so after a while, we sat down for the service and my uncle gave a great eulogy, and my grandfather, who's still alive, sat in front of me, and I saw him struggle enormously throughout the service. And so we buried my grandmother on her and my grandfather's 60th wedding anniversary, which was quite a thing to deal with for us. And so after the funeral, we went back to our grandmother and grandfather's home, and all of the men of the family went out back, and we sat on his back porch as we did whenever we were kids, and we drank some whiskey, and we listened to some Bob Wills, and we kind of thought about the times that we spent as children back there on Easter egg hunts and sitting back there listening to countless stories from our grandfather about our grandmother, about she would only allow him two whiskeys a day. So we kind of had a laugh about that, and it just kind of, it was hard to think about the time that we had spent back there, and it was hard to think about my mother leaving the funeral, asking me how she was going to deal with this. She didn't know if she could get over it, and I just told her with time. Time will take care of it, eventually. And so, after we left my grandfather's house, we packed up all the stuff that he was giving away, which is even harder to deal with because it's as if he was giving away every aspect of his life that was tied to my grandmother, to his past life. He was handing everything down as if he was just waiting for his time to give up. And so when we went back to Houston, it took time, a lot of time, for my mother to get over it, for her sisters to get over it, for my cousins to get over it. And my grandfather, who is still alive with us today, is still struggling with it. Still looks at pictures from time of my grandmother every morning. And, but he's in good spirits, and hopefully, eventually, we will all be okay with it in time. So I keep my grandfather's watch with me. Thankfully, I kept it from, saved it from the flood. And I take a look at it, and I just hope that we all just have more time.
That's beautiful. It's a beautiful symbol, and it's a beautiful motif. And you know that my grandfather's watch obviously means so much to me, too. And that's a beautiful story, Joey. It is a beautiful story, and the way that unfolded was pretty, it was pretty wonderful. What is it that you'd like us to take away from that story?
I guess just don't take things for granted. You never, especially time. Don't take time for granted that you have left with your loved ones. My grandmother was healthy, and most people that we lose are healthy whenever they just are suddenly taken from us. So just don't take the time you have with them for granted.
What do you say to your grandfather when you see him?
Well, I tell him that I'd probably be a better sinner if he would have paid more attention to me than my grandmother.
Well, I think a couple of whiskeys from the time you were born probably falls under the category of a mild sin.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, it's good.
And
that's
he interrupts me by telling him to pour him another one. So, you know, we have a good time. We have a good time.
You know, he's the kind of guy you love. You never met him. Am I right? That is so wonderful. Thank you for that. And I mean, thank you, really. This is Hank Rubicek with Nicole Rocherlin and Tatiana Gago and guest storytellers James Etta Marshall and Joey Mann with stories about handling devastating episodes on So What's Your Story? Pacifica Radio, fuel for peace, KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston. A student really reached into the heart of every student in my class when she told the story that defied the fear that came with vulnerability, which is really the greatest human denominator. It was a story that she had to tell, and she said it, and we were all happy she did. And this is Kelly Lang from February 6th, 2014. And Nicole, this is a really tough story, and let's just play the first 5 minutes of it, please, if we could.
Kelly Lang. One of your students, I went home and listened to one of your podcasts with J.J. Simmons on her book, Without Bruises. Mm-hmm. After I thought about it, JJ's story inspired me to tell mine. I have bruises that I carry with me. I know what it's like to feel alone, abandoned, unloved, and like no one will understand. If anyone can use my story to ignite any sort of hope or empowerment to get through their darkness, I'm happy to share it. Mental, emotional, and physical abuse is something I have dealt with my whole life. My mother was manic depressive. As a child, I didn't understand why she did the things she did. There's support groups with people that have mental illnesses, but not for those who are impacted by it. So I didn't understand why she locked herself in the closet for days, screaming, why she tried to kill herself, why she was carried out of her house on a stretcher and taken away in an ambulance, why she flung herself down the stairs, crushing my tiny 5-year-old body at the bottom while my sister ran for help. I have scars on my knees from the glass that shattered when the picture frames on the wall came down with her. I would often just have to know that Mommy can't be with us because she's in the psychiatric ward right now. Just to give you a glimpse of the few things that were my norms growing up as a kid. So I became really good at hiding. I created spaces for myself that were my safe zones. I strung Christmas lights and glittery snowflakes under my bed, and I would lay there for hours dreaming I was really a princess like in the fairy tales I would read, and my real parents would come and find me and take me away from all of this. I would sneak out of my window and ride my bike to the end of the street and climb the biggest oak tree to watch the sunset and stay there until after the streetlights came on just to stare up at the stars. Growing up with her, I wondered all of the time and I begged her, why can't you just be the mom I need you to be? Why can't you just be normal? I know the answer and that there isn't one all in the same. So I shove it down a little deeper and remind myself that when I have children, I will never do this to them. She was a mastermind manipulator. She knew that she wasn't the mother that she should be, and she would throw it in my face when I asked if she could participate in, you know, something normal, like coming to my high school graduation. She would tell me things like, it just must be so nice to be so perfect and know everything then. And I'm just a shitty mother, and you're the only reason I keep living my excruciating life. You have no idea what it's like, the torture inside my head. So sit down, sit here now, and tell me how much you hate me. Then later, she would turn around and be the best person in the world, and be everything I loved about her. She was the most magnetic person you'd ever meet. She'd swoop me up in a rush of love and shower me with presents and fun secret trips together, just us two. She made everyone she met feel like they were the most important person in the world. I've been in and out of therapy since I was 7. As a child, my mother would constantly tell me that she thinks that I have the same mental illness. She would beat me down with her words just to raise me back up. She would tell me I'm too skinny, too fat, that I didn't try hard enough, and that I was beautiful and smart and wonderful, and as long as I did my best, that's all she could ask for, and that she was proud. I just didn't know at the time that I was a kid and I hadn't had behavior modeled in a way to be able to express my anger or any emotions that was healthy, and I had a lot of anger and a lot of sadness. I never thought I was crazy, but you know, when a crazy person keeps telling you that you are, you tend to question yourself. So I drank, I smoked, I starved myself, I made myself throw up. I swallowed pills prescribed to me to numb my pain. I screamed, I fought, and I was silent, and I acted like everything was okay. I went to college several times. I tried to go to Sam Houston State after I graduated high school in 2004. I couldn't cope at the time because my parents had just gotten a divorce. My mother abandoned me, and she left for Italy with some man. After I was always there for her, always there to wipe her tears and tell her she's okay, I was the physical barrier from her splatting on the floor at the end of the staircase. So I escaped into a man I dated. I went to SHSU, but I was so depressed, I took the remainder of my mother's sleeping pills and slept all day, missing class. I went home to him on the weekends, and he became my new hiding place. I guess he also recognized in me that I was scared, emotionally abused, and easily manipulated girl. I stopped going to school, I withdrew from SHSU, and spent every moment with him. I came over to his house one day and walked past the kitchen and quickly realized there was a table set for two with candles and a red jewelry box in the middle of a plate. I was so scared, I went to the bathroom and climbed out of the window, and I drove away. I knew somewhere deep inside of me something wasn't right with this relationship. I had no more friends. He was very controlling, and he basically wanted me to be barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen and to just be his wife. I knew I was too young to be married. I didn't want to be a mother yet, and I wanted something more for my life, so I kept driving. I drove, and I ended up getting a puppy. I went to my mom's downtown apartment where I had been staying, and he came over to talk about what had happened and act like he was understanding. He hated that I got a puppy. He said he couldn't have me love anything more than I loved him, which he told me after he broke her neck and smeared blood and feces all over the bed and the walls of the apartment, handing her limp body to me by her tiny head. I ran out of the apartment screaming, and he followed me outside and pushed me into the pool to stop my screams. He pushed me under. He pulled me up by my hair to tell me if I wasn't going to be with him, I wasn't going to be with anyone else. Distraught, I packed a small bag and left for California to be with my sister, who had already lived in a matchbox-sized apartment with two other girls while getting her master's. I spent a long time crying and severely depressed in her tiny room. My sister always has to have a plan, which she later instilled in me. So she told me to write a life plan of what I want and what I want to achieve. Starting small, I went back to community college, and I applied and went to Oklahoma State for 2 years. My family members that said that they would help me pay for my college reneged at the end of every semester, and I would have to beg and plead for them to pay my tuition. My mother would call me most of the days to tell me that she was selling her silverware, anything she can, to pay for my tuition, which was ridiculous, considering I came from a family with money, who all lived in an affluent area, and who paid for my sister to go to Smith and Pepperdine, no questions asked. I didn't understand why she was favored our whole lives, and I had literally had to beg for everything. I had to give up and come home to take care of my mother. Two of my aunts had passed away, and my mom was in and out of the psychiatric ward again after several attempts or threats of suicide. No one else could handle her or knew when she was taking her medication. I referred back to my life plan, and I was so ashamed that I had been through so much and I had deviated from it. I applied to the University of Houston downtown and started school again. This time, I had to make a promise to myself to make sure things would be different. I had to promise myself that no matter what, no one would be able to manipulate me, hurt me, or hold money over my head and stand in the way of my goals. I was not going to hide or run anymore. I was old enough at this point to apply for loans on my own without being dependent on my parents' income. I got a full-time job as a preschool teacher, and I made it a point to start their foundation with empowering the children to be who they are, to be brave, and always use their words to stand up for themselves. It had to be me to make the choice to go to school, to do better for myself, so I can create my own happiness and my own life. I had to make the choice to be on my own, to do things my way. The past has made me who I am today. I made the choice to be better than what had happened to me. It's scary leaving the comfort of what you know, even if it is abusive and unhealthy. It's what you know. For so long, I have felt like I've been running down this dark tunnel, not sure of when I'm going to reach the light at the end or even if there is an end. But I have to remind myself that there is an end, and it's what I make it this time. I have to use everything that I've been through, the good and the bad, to guide myself and my life from here on out and be better than that. My bruises will heal through the love that I show people and my determination.
Thank you, Nicole. Segment that I didn't really want to play, I actually have another tape. And as difficult as this was to hear, the other part of the story is even more difficult. I'm so glad that we played that. That took an enormous amount of strength, as you might imagine. And Nicole, you know JJ, so you know where this is coming from. And this is sort of one of the products from JJ Simmons, who's been on the show a couple of times, talking about domestic violence. So hard, so difficult, and so, if you will, devastating, right? Any comments? Anybody have any remarks about that one, if it's possible to have a remark?
That's heavy.
It is heavy. It is heavy. That's the only word you can really think of. Yeah. And you wonder whether or not, you know, it almost sounds like a Lifetime movie.
Yes.
You don't think that you would even know anyone. You know, I love my job for a lot of reasons, and all of you know that. But sometimes hearing the stories that I do from my students make me love them a lot more because they're very real, you know, and this is just an example of that. It's pretty magnificent. It really is.
It was very hard to listen to, but it was also inspiring to someone who has maybe been abused and still can overcome. So, I mean, she's definitely telling people that you can overcome. And again, it also comes down to a choice. She made a choice to overcome. So I enjoyed the story.
Thank you. Yeah. Very, very strong. Very, very strong. And, you know, speak about strength. I had mentioned, just to change the tone a little bit, you know, another wonderful person in this studio, James Setta, not only told us a great story earlier, but she is a poet, and she's going to prove it in just a moment, by the way, because you are an award-winning poet, right, James Setta?
I am.
You are. And you write the kind of poetry that sparks raw emotion. Why poetry to begin with?
I fell in love with Dr. Seuss' Green Eggs and Ham.
Ah.
And after I memorized the whole book, I started performing it in the mirror. And my mom was like, okay, you need to
You're a strange
poetry.
Person, and therefore you need to turn to poetry. I got you. Now, you've got about 90 seconds. Have you got a good poem for us?
I do have a good poem.
All right.
I could do it before 90 seconds.
Go.
Okay. This is Kingdom Come by Just Jim. He was my kingdom come. Cold black skin against my thighs. Rainstorm cloud eyes electrifies my soul with lightning bolt glances. His beauty draped across my lap. My fingertips got trapped in his tar-like dreadlocks that melted from Africa's suns. Cathedral shoulders. Solid oak pew fingertips. Mass choir muscles that bellowed out hallelujah when his body was placed upon mine. See, I was his queen. But he was a king, and in a second, he loved me for a year. And in a moment, he loved me through a lifetime. He was my kingdom come.
You're ridiculous. You know that? You're ridiculous. I don't think that I've met a more talented person, you know, since me. I don't know. No, I mean, you are really the epitome of talent. That is magnificent.
Thank you.
How do you do that?
I don't know. That's one thing I want to say was great about being in your class is that I had all these pots on the stove,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know which way to go. And when you wrote that you are a storyteller, and I was like, oh, I'm a storyteller in acting. I'm a storyteller in dance. I'm a storyteller in poetry.
Yep.
It was that one moment Beautiful. That I realized this profound thing that I know what I'm supposed to
do. Well, you know what? American songwriter Buddy Brewy, best known for producing hits by Roy Orbison and the Atlantic Rhythm Section, argued pretty much what we've argued tonight and even what that poem addresses. Rock bottom is solid ground, and a dead-end street is just a place to turn around. Our tellers tonight would certainly buy into that. Thank you, James Adam Marshall and Joey Mann and Kelly Lang and Katie Galloway for the kind of narratives that will forever remind us that stories stretch the boundaries of the human heart. We also want to wish our friends in the Jewish community a sweet and peaceful Rosh Hashanah tonight. Happy New Year. We won't be wishing you happy Yom Kippur. That's like saying Merry Confession, right? Don't you dare move, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger will be reaching out in the darkness with cool classics for the cooler you. You make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving a great story, my friends, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and along with the entire SWYS team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Celebrate the streets of Houston this fall with Cigna Sunday Streets. During Cigna Sunday Streets, a major thoroughfare is closed to motorized traffic. Without cars on the road, you'll be able to enjoy walking, running, dancing, cycling, and socializing with friends and family. Cigna Sunday Streets promotes being physically active, meeting your neighbors, and exploring your community. Fall 2017 Sunday Street event dates have been set. Mark your calendars for October 1st, November 5th, and December 3rd. Please help spread the word. Visit HoustonSpecialEvents.org for event locations and hours, bilingual information, fun facts, and more. KPFT Houston.
KPFT Houston has a fund drive coming up soon, and we need your help to make it a success. Each fund drive, volunteers answer phones and take the vital pledges from listeners that fund KPFT operations throughout the year. Volunteer efforts make a difference, and together, we'll make this drive fun and successful. We are utilizing a new system for pledge taking, so both new and seasoned phone volunteers are asked to sign up for training. Just call the membership department at 713-526-4000, extension 314, to schedule your training date and time. After your training, visit kpft.org and click the Sign Up Genius link to sign up for your phone volunteer shift. If you are part of an organization providing three or more volunteers for a pledge drive phone shift, we'll thank your organization.